This is the Introduction to C++ course lecture number 8. Today we're going to go over binary file input and output, structures, and classes. And this lecture we're going to start on some of the basics of C++ and how C++ distinguishes itself from C. So, we'll get a short introduction to classes. And maybe we'll continue that in a later lecture. Some things to note right now are if you want to hear anything or any topics in the upcoming two lectures, please send us an email at itcc_teachers@pclx.com or post on the message board or get in contact with me somehow through IRC. So, and as always, if you have any questions or comments or anything, please just post them on the IRC channel as I talk, and I'll get to those. So, slide number 2, we're going to do part 2 of file input output. So, in the previous lecture, we kind of looked at sequential file input and output, and sequential meaning that we start at the top of the file, reading in values, and then we get those sequentially from the file. So we might get the first value from the file, then the second, then the third, and we can't really skip around the file at all. So sometimes this is a problem. Like, what if there's only a single byte in the whole file that we want, and we can't get that single byte unless we go through everything else? So one solution to that is to use random access input-output, or else that's otherwise known as, non-sequential. So before we were also looking at ASCII files, and ASCII files are basically human-readable if we open them up in Notepad, because in ASCII every single number is assigned a letter or a sound or something that's something meaningful that has a higher meaning than just a number. So we can open up these types of files in Notepad and just understand what's going on. And in general, each character takes up 8 bits of memory. There are things called Unicode that Microsoft has started and that other groups have started. And Unicode is used because in different languages, there are a lot of different characters that need to be expressed. And ASCII just doesn't have enough room to express all these characters in 256 different characters. So this has been expanded to try to accommodate for other languages. And so today we're going to talk about binary files. And binary files aren't exactly human readable. They're mainly program readable. But they're very efficient ways to store data. So if you think about how data is stored in RAM, like a long could take up 32 bits, and you know, the most significant bit would be the negative flag. If you think about it that way, then that's exactly how it's going to be stored inside the file. And that makes it kind of hard for Notepad to read it because it doesn't know how to interpret different pieces of data. Like, is this one a long or is this one a float? It isn't specified anywhere, so Notepad can't easily determine what or how to interpret that data. So on slide number 3, let's just take a look at how Notepad would interpret certain things. So we define a variable, unsigned character num, to be equal to 65. And we're going to store that in an ASCII file and then as in a binary file. So in the first case, we're going to store it as ASCII. Then the number 65 is placed in the file. And what we're going to see is the top line of the two dashes there, the 65. So why do we see 65 if we write it to an ASCII file? Because the number 65 is placed there as two ASCII values. So two bytes are stored in the file. The first byte corresponds to the number 6, and the second byte corresponds to the number 5. But they aren't actually 6 and 5. There's some value that corresponds to 6 and 5 within the ASCII code. And secondly, if we look at this in a binary file, then if we store 65, that will be stored as a single byte. And the Notepad program is going to interpret the value 65 as a capital A. So it's just going to show us a capital A. And that's not really what we want, because a capital A is is an interpretation of our data. We stored an unsigned character there with a value of 65. We didn't mean for it to be interpreted as a capital A. So hopefully that distinction is kind of clear. So if you, in general, if you write a binary file to a file, then it won't be interpreted by Notepad because Notepad doesn't know how to interpret it. You might have a long stored as your first number, and then you might have a character, and Notepad doesn't know like what scheme you're using to store all of these things. But Notepad will try to interpret it, and the way Notepad interprets it is through ASCII characters. So just like here, we intended to store the value 65, but we got the value A, and so some characters will appear. We didn't mean for an A to appear there, but it did. So in slide number 4, we're going through binary files. So one of the advantages of binary files, although ASCII files can be done this way too, is that they can be read non-sequentially. We don't have to go through data by data. Again, if we want to obtain a single value in the file, we don't have to read in every single value in the file if we already know its position. When we can tell the computer to just go to a certain position in the file and to read a certain data byte. And in fact, this is what we're going to do when we're reading in a binary file, such as a bitmap. We might go to a very specific place in the file and read in, for example, the width of the picture or the height of the picture. And this is very useful because we don't have to read in the entire header of a bitmap file, although it isn't that big. And so we can just zap out those values, and then we can head to the start of our uncompressed image file, and then just sequentially read in the rest of that. Even though we opened it in binary mode, we don't have to skip around. So on slide number 5, let's just take a look at how we're going to open up one of these binary files. And it looks a lot like how we opened up the ASCII file. And in fact, it's exactly the same, except for that last parameter in the constructor there. So when we declare a new variable type in file, then our second parameter that we pass is going to be iOS colon colon in, or iOS colon colon binary. So there are a few new things here. First of all, we have a pipe in between the in and binary. And instead of being treated as a pipe, in C it's known as a bitwise OR operator. And without going into the details of bitwise OR, in general, if you have a pipe and you connect two different constants, the in and binary are just constant values. If you connect those two constants and they're set up in the appropriate way, then you can sort of append them together. So you're sending to the in file, you're sending the constant in and the constant binary. So the OR just smashes them together into a single value and then sends it to infile, and then infile can parse that single value and figure out that you specified you want it as an input and you want it as a binary file. So whenever you see this a lot in like Windows code, whenever you see that OR sign repeated connecting a bunch of constants together, and that just means it's smashing all those constants together into one value. And there's a special way you have to set up your constants to get it to do that correctly, and that's called bit masking. We specify two constant values there. We specify in and binary, and in allows us to open the file for reading as input, and then binary lets us treat the file as a binary file instead of an ASCII file. So pretty easy stuff. You can just paste that line. There are also some other constant parameters you can put in there. Instead of in and binary, you can also do out, and you can do append, and there are some others. For example, if you open up a file for reading, then if the file doesn't exist, should we automatically create a new file? Well, that's one of the other things that you can specify within that parameter list. A lot of neat stuff, and if you look up the documentation on MSDN or something, then you can probably find it pretty easily. Alright, slide number 6. Let's try reading from a file. So, we start off, we're going to declare a buffer. of 100 bytes. So it'll be 100 bytes long, and then we're going to declare our in file, just like we did in the last slide. We're going to open it up, and we're going to treat it as input and in binary mode. So then the new command is right here. The new command is infile.read. And in this case, we're going to read from the file 100 bytes, and we're going to store those 100 bytes inside the buffer we just made. So, and also note that this function call is inside an if statement. And we have a not in front of this value. So, what we're saying is, remember that functions have return codes? Well, this read command is going to return a certain value, and that value is going to be true or false. So we determine that a value is true if it's non-zero, and that it's false if it is zero. So in this case, the read is going to return zero or false if the read doesn't operate correctly. So if the read function returns a zero, then we know that an error has occurred. So we have an if statement there. So let's say read returns a zero, so that's false. And if it's false, it's not going to execute the commands in there. So it returns a false, and then that not is going to say not false, or in other words, true. So since that condition is true, we're going to execute the error has occurred commands. So that's just a little how that works there. So again, we read from the file. If it doesn't work right, the function's going to return a zero, which is false. And then that not is going to turn it into true. And then since it's if true, then we execute the commands inside the braces. And those are the commands that we're going to take if an error has occurred. So if the read returns a positive number or a non-zero value, then it's going to be true, and then the not's going to turn it into false. So we're not going to execute the commands inside the braces. So that's a little how that works. So again, the read command takes a pointer to some memory location that has room to store 100 bytes. And then the read command is going to store the first 100 bytes of our file into that buffer. So up here, by saying char buffer 100, we're allocating 100 bytes of memory for our buffer. And this is static allocation. We can also allocate these 100 bytes dynamically like we did in the last lecture. So if we look below, then here we're doing some dynamic allocation. The dynamic allocation is pretty easy to understand as well. We have a pointer to buffer, so that's 32 bits in this case. It can change when we get to 64-bit processors. It might change to 64 bits. But in this case, it's going to be a 32-bit buffer or a 32-bit pointer, because all pointers right now are 32 bits. And then with the new char 100 command, we're going to allocate 100 bytes of memory. And after we execute a lot of code, then we're going to finally delete the buffer. And Slavik mentioned that it depends on the compiler and not the CPU. There's actually a recent thread on game dev about this. And it was concluded in the end that the sizes of int and long and everything are dependent on the compiler. Although, I believe that how the compiler sets it is based on the CPU. So, Slavik just mentioned that the compiler compiles for the CPU, not the CPU itself. So maybe we'll have to think about this one for a while. But since the compiler is writing code and translating it into assembly, the compiler does determine what values longs and shorts and integers compile into. And the compiler is specific to a certain CPU. So, in essence, the compiler really does determine the lengths of the short and long and everything. But that the compiler is dependent on the CPU, so you might be able to argue either way. But the CPU itself does make the assembly code that determines, you know, how much memory something allocates or something like that. And we mentioned you can compile 64-bit code on a 32-bit CPU. And we can, but I mean, there are 64-bit variables that you can declare that are compiler dependent. For example, underscore int 64 or long in the G++. And there are certain tricks that the compiler uses to accurately manipulate those values, and they turn out to be really slow, or slower than the 32-bit values, because they have to do all these tricks to manipulate 64-bit values. So I guess the compiler can define different length variables, but as to what's fastest to manipulate, that's dependent on the CPU. Okay, so back to files, slide number 7. So we just discussed how we can read data from a file in a big chunk. Well, we can also, since we're doing non-sequential access, we can seek through a file. So there's this command called seekg, and there's this thing in the file called a sort of get cursor. It's not in the file, but it's just an imaginary cursor that when you open up a file, it's automatically set to the first, the very top of the file, the very beginning of the file. And wherever this cursor is, that's where we're going to get stuff from. So whenever we do a read operation, then this cursor, the get cursor, is going to read 100 bytes starting at the get cursor. So yeah, the get is sort of a pointer to a certain position in the file. And we're just going to get 100 bytes from that cursor, wherever it's located. And we can set where that cursor is located through the command seekg. And in this case, at the top, when we use seekg, we're setting it to 100 bytes from the beginning of the file. And it's always absolute. So when, no matter where our cursor is, if we put 100 in seekg, it's always going to put it at 100 bytes into the file. And I'm asked, can we just use getcar? And you can use any function that you want to get values from your file. And there are actually a lot of different values that are, or there are actually a lot of different functions that are stored in the fstream class, in the ifstream class. I'm just showing you a few choice ones. There are easier ones, like if you're reading in one value at a time than using the read, because read is intended for reading in lots of data at once. So you can look those up if you want to. But you probably should stick with C++ commands that are in the fstream class. And getcar probably isn't in the fstream class, although it may be. I don't know every single function, but in general, you should probably stick with C++ commands if you're writing in C++. And actually, these are pretty easy to use, I'd say. If you just in file.read, it's pretty easy. So if you want to move to a place relative to your current cursor position, then you can use the command tellg, and that tells us where the get cursor is in the file. So if you call the tellg command, that'll tell you, like, we're at 100 bytes into the file. So one way to do relative cursor moves is to put in the tellg and then just add 100. And that will move us 100 bytes forward from wherever our cursor location is. And it turns out that there's actually a put cursor as well in slide number 8. That's used when we're writing to a file. So it's the same thing when we're writing to a file, except we have the write command and the seekp command. So I'm not going to go into those because for the homework we're just going to read from a file, read in bitmaps and everything. But if you're interested in writing to a file, then you can check out the link I put down there. That seems to be pretty cool. Or there are lots of resources online, again, for more in-depth coverage of what we just covered. So then on slide 9, just make sure that you always close your file when you're done reading or writing to it. And that's just done by the close function. And the dot in there, we're actually going to get into later on in this lecture what that dot means. Why is a close necessary? Well, if you have Word open and you're editing a document, it's really tough to try to move the file around because the operating system oftentimes doesn't let you move the file around, like if you drag it around to a different folder or something. If it's open in Word, then Word sort of has a lock on the file. And sometimes in your code, you can get a lock on a file too, because if two programs try to access the same file at once, there can be pretty bad consequences if they try to overwrite the same data. When you also declare an ifstream object or something, whenever you use ifstream, you do have to make sure that you include #include fstream. Or just fstream at the top of your file, and then using namespace std. And if you do that at the top, then those will include the proper headers, so it'll find the right functions for you. Alright, so now moving to slide number 10, we're going to talk about structures. And structures are sort of the preliminary to classes. And they're really neat because they let us simplify a lot of stuff. They're one of the reasons that C is a high-level language, because we can put together lots of values in memory together. We can put those together to form more logical structures. So just some things that structures can solve is that, earlier we had the problem that we could only return a single variable from a function. So then we got into arrays and we thought, we can return an array, but what if we wanted to return an integer and a float? We can't put that into an array easily. So a second way we did it was through, we can send a bunch of pointers to our function, and we can actually modify those variables through the pointers. But then what if we have lots of different variables we want to modify in this function? We can't have a 32-item parameter list. Not only is that inefficient, but that's a lot of code to write out. So a third way to return things from functions, if we want to mix up floats and integers and everything, is to send a structure, or to return a structure. So one thing that we can think of as a structure on slide number 11. In Pong, we were faced with the problem that we had, for every ball on the screen, we only implemented one ball, but let's say we wanted more than one ball. Now that would be a nightmare to implement, because we have the ball's x and y positions, we have its x and y velocities, the ball's color, we have the ball's size, all this stuff about the ball. And, you know, if we had more than one ball, well, first of all, we'll have to make all these into arrays, and we just have a bunch of free variables floating around. You know, we could have ball x, ball y, ball x vel, ball y velocity, etc. But we still have all these variables floating around, and they're all kind of unorganized. And, well, wouldn't it be cool if we could say, this is what a ball is, and then just list, well, a ball has an x position, it has a y position, it has a velocity, it has a color. Wouldn't that be neat? So on slide number 12, this is what a structure is designed to do. So we we're defining a ball to have certain properties. And the ball has an x and y position, has a width and a height, it has an x and y velocity. These are all properties of a ball. they sort of describe a ball. And the best thing is that we sort of declared our, or defined our own data type in this situation called ball. And that data type actually has all these other data types within it. And the neat thing is, I only used integers here, but you can also use floats, and you can use whatever other data type you want to put in there. In fact, you can put a structure inside another structure. So this is sort of like a high-level way of thinking about things. We're breaking down the game into different objects. We're saying there are balls in our game, and those can do things, and we have paddles, and you know those have properties. We're not to the do things yet, but the balls have different properties, the paddles have different properties, and they all have things in common. So on slide number 13, let's talk about this structure a little. So we just made up our own variable type called ball. And one of the neat things about structures is we can sort of count up how big this structure is. So back on slide number 12, notice that we have 2, 4, 6 different integers inside that structure. And the structure is just each of these variables inside it right after each other in memory. So to figure out how many bytes of memory we're going to allocate by declaring a ball object, then all we have to do is add up all of the bytes it takes to represent all of its integers in here. So we have 4 plus 4 plus 4 plus 4 plus 4 plus 4. And that comes out to 6 times 4, so 24 bytes. And if we have floats in there, if we have doubles, if we have characters, we can still add all those together. But there's one little caveat here. If it doesn't, if the final number isn't divisible by 4, then the compiler, in most cases, if you don't tell it not to, it'll often round that up to the nearest 32-bit boundary or 4-byte boundary. Because, like we discussed earlier, a 32-bit processor is best and optimized for processing 32 bits at a time. So if our structure is 32 bits long, we'll get a few performance improvements if we're moving the data around. So in some applications, you might not want that to happen. And I recently actually came up with one. I was sending network packets across a network, and we needed 22 byte packets to be sent. And the problem was that basically our receiver was only expecting a 22 byte packet, and it would crash if we sent it anything other than a 22 byte packet. And so the code I wrote was sending it a 24 byte packet, although in my structure I specified 22 bytes, because the compiler was automatically rounding up to that 24 byte boundary. So I had to tell it, you know, round down or just keep it at 22 bytes and we'll just be fine. So we calculated that it was 24 bytes, and we also said that all of those values are stored contiguously in memory right after each other. So the compiler, in my case, the compiler automatically packed the 22 into a 24 byte structure, because that's what's fastest for the processor to handle. But I wanted a 22 byte structure, or else what's at the end of the Ethernet cable is going to crash. So I need to tell the compiler not to pad my 22 byte structure with extra zeros just to make it faster for the microprocessor. So you usually don't have to do that. Usually when you make a structure, it's just fine. And I'm asked, who wrote the receiving software? And we're actually designing sort of a hardware device, so it was very you actually had to reprogram you had to flash some memory to get that working correctly. And well, it just required a 22 byte structure. I'll leave it at that. So in slide number 14, how do we access structures? So here's one cool way of accessing a structure. First of all, we have this new ball data type. So we can just say ball, pong ball, and I'm calling my variable name pong ball. And then all I have to do to access the x variable or the y variable is just to put a little dot there. So pongball.x equals 50, or pongball.y equals 100. And whenever I want to access the x variable or the y variable, I mean, we're going to treat this just like any other variable. So that unit there, the pongball.x, is just like saying ball x or ball y. It's the exact same thing. So structures are pretty easy to define, declare, and access, right? And we're using that dot character. So on slide 15, what if we wanted to dynamically allocate one of these ball structures? Well, it's pretty easy too. We just do like we've always been doing. We do the ball star or ball asterisk pong ball to say that's a pointer. Then we're allocating enough room for the ball structure by doing new ball, and that's returning a pointer to the newly allocated memory, and we're storing that in that pointer, the pong ball pointer. And then there'll be some code, and then we're going to delete the final. We're going to just not delete it, but free that memory back to the operating system. So here's a little problem that people have run into. So how can we access pong ball's members? Well, I put an example there. Well, what we want to do is we want to access the contents of pong ball because it's a pointer, and then we want to do the dot thing and get the x, right? So what if I have a structure defined inside the pong ball structure of another ball? So let's say we have a ball and then we have a parent ball, and the parent ball maybe gives birth to the child or something. And in the child, we want to keep track of who our parent ball is. So there could be a member added to the pong ball structure called parent ball, which is itself a ball. So let's say I want to access, okay, so I have a pointer to my ball, and I want to figure out what the x position of its parent is. So if they're both pointers, I'd have to do this really complicated looking expression here to set it equal to 50. And that's like really confusing. So on slide 16, there was a little improvement made to that, and that's an arrow. So I gave the two examples there in the new arrow notation. So as you can see, that makes it a lot clearer what we're actually doing here with our pointers. So as you can see, pong ball, arrow, parent ball, arrow x is a lot easier to understand than whatever I wrote above that. So the arrow is sort of a really convenient way of accessing the contents of pointers to structures. And the thing is, you've already seen this arrow notation before. And in fact, whenever you call a member function to that ITCC framework class, you always put an arrow there. And you may not have realized why yet. Well, we haven't gotten to why yet, but we are going to very soon. And also, when we did those file operations up above, like on slide number 9, we had infile.close. Well, could that dot be the same dot that we use to access structures on slide 14? It turns out that it is. So on slide number 17, we're going to try to get into classes a little. We got a question, is infile a pointer? On slide number 5, infile isn't a pointer. But we use a dot to access, for example, the read and the close commands because it isn't a pointer. Just like on slide number 14, our pong ball isn't a pointer, yet we use a dot there to access its x and y members. So that's sort of the same thing. So let's take a look at classes on slide number 17. So we're saying inside the graphics framework and with the files, I'm calling it a function, but in structures we could only have variables inside a structure. But with a class, we can have functions inside a structure as well, and that's called a class. So when we think of object-oriented programming, before we thought of the Pong field as, you know, there are a few paddles and a ball and we're moving the ball around and, you know, the user kind of moves around the paddles. But what if we thought of it in an object-oriented way and thought, well, there's a ball, and the ball has certain properties. It has an X and Y position, and the ball can do certain things, like the ball can move, and the ball can change its velocity, and the paddles can move, and they can change their velocity. So I'm thinking of everything on the field as an object that has certain properties and certain actions that it can do. And this is one of the ways that object-oriented programmers think, and why this is a little different than traditional C programming. So on slide number 18, just a second, I guess I have a phone call. Or not. All right, so on slide number 18, I gave a definition of a C-ball class. So this is our Pong ball, and it has certain variables up at the top. It has an X position, a Y position, an X velocity, a Y velocity. And then it also has certain functions down below in the public section. It has functions where we can get its X position and its Y position. We can set its velocities. Or actually, it sets its velocities itself, I guess. Or something external could set them. And then the ball can also move, and that's down at the bottom, too. And our ball can also initialize itself, which is what the constructor is, and it can destroy itself, which is what the deconstructor is. So our ball is a sort of object. So in slide number 19, let's go through a few of these elements of a class and discuss what they are. So first of all, you might have noticed me using a weird notation. I put M underscore in front of some variables, and I put the C in front of ball, and I haven't used this G underscore thing yet. But this is a common way that programmers will use to represent member variables, which is what the M is for, and classes, which is what the uppercase C is for. So we need some way of distinguishing between structures and classes. So often people will put a capital C in front of their class name. And member variables are member variables, sometimes you have to use, it's very convenient within a class to be able to tell which variables are member variables and which variables are like from the function call or something. So we often put an M underscore in front of our variable name. And this just represents that the variable is inside our class. So we can access it just like it's inside our class. Because it is inside our class. And programmers often put a G underscore in front of global variables, so we can easily distinguish those. That's sort of a good programming habit, I'd say. And this is actually a remnant of something that Microsoft came up with called Hungarian notation, which is a method of naming your variables. And what Hungarian notation attempted to do was so that a programmer could sit down and look at any variable that he created and immediately be able to tell the type of the variable, whether it was unsigned or long, or whether it was whatever type it was declared as. And that could be a good method, it could not be a good method, but it often led to long, complex-looking variable names. So it isn't as often used nowadays, but you will see remnants of it in the DirectX and Windows SDK documentation. But Hungarian notation is interesting. It seems to be that some people love it, some people hate it, honestly. So you don't see it nowadays as often as you used to, but it used to be that within Microsoft, all their code was written in Hungarian notation, so that people could easily determine what the type of a variable was. So in slide number 20, let's just start decomposing this class. And first of all, we have public members and we have private members of the class. So what's the difference between public and private? Well, privately declared variables and functions can only be accessed from functions within the class itself. So if I have functions that are declared or defined inside my class, then I can only access private variables and functions and public variables and functions that are inside my class. But if I'm, for example, here's a good example. In the code above, when we were, when we're doing our structure, like on slide number 14, I would only be able to access the variables x and y if those were publicly defined. If they were privately defined, then I could only access those two variables from a function inside my class that was defined inside my class. So what's the advantage to this, you might say? Well, the advantage is that this is one of the three object-oriented programming main ideas, and that's the idea of encapsulation. So the general idea when you're writing a class is that you're making a black box that things go in into, which are inputs, and things come out of, which are outputs. And the programmer shouldn't have to understand what goes on inside the black box. He should only have to be able to look at the interface to the box, or the publicly defined functions, and be able to use the black box as it was intended. And that's the whole idea behind classes. It's to take advantage of this encapsulation concept and make it so that the programmer doesn't have to understand exactly how every single function works. All he should have to do is take a look at the interface to the class and then be able to program it however he wants to. And this is just a short little segue here, but this is sort of how we have to approach the human brain if we want to study that. We treat it as a black box. We can't really look inside it, although there are some new technologies. But psychology is sort of the study of giving it certain inputs, having the brain process them, and then looking at the outputs or the behavioral changes. So in some ways, the brain is thought of as a black box. And this is, unfortunately, it's really tough to figure out what's going on inside the black box. And that's what our scientists are trying to do today. But it's a very difficult process. And like a human, we don't have to understand how it works. We just have to understand how to work it. So on slide number 21, let's take a look at another function, which is called the constructor. Every single class that we write can have one or more constructors. And a constructor is a function that is called immediately when an object of this class is instantiated. So how do we tell a constructor from a regular function? Well, the constructor always has the same name as the class does. So, what the constructors are usually used for are to allocate dynamic memory, or dynamically allocate memory. So, right when our class pops up, we might send it a few variables. For example, with our class ball here, we're sending it a few variables, the x and y position and the width and height. And what if for those widths and heights we need to dynamically allocate some memory to store a bunch of information depending on those numbers? Well, within the constructor we can do this. And our constructor for cBall at this moment is just assigning internal member variables these values that we pass in. But it can actually do a lot more. So on slide number 22 we also have another sort of function that's specific to classes called the deconstructor. And every class that we can write can have a single deconstructor. We don't have a separate deconstructor for every constructor we write. the deconstructor is pretty neat because we don't have to call it as a programmer. It's automatically called when this object is deallocated from memory, or when it's destroyed by the computer. So within the deconstructor, we might want to do some things like deallocate memory or clean up a little behind us. And on the IRC, we were asked, deconstructor does garbage collection, right? Well, garbage collection is sort of a different concept. And in languages such as Java, we don't have to, when we dynamically allocate memory, we don't have to specifically deallocate it. The compiler will do that for us. Or I'm sorry, the Java language has garbage collection in there that will automatically deallocate that memory for us when it isn't going to be used anymore. And in C and C++, we do have to free that memory. So in the deconstructor, we just explicitly say we want to free this memory. But it's not really garbage collection. It's a more convenient way of doing it. But I don't think C++ uses garbage collection. Microsoft actually recently released a managed C++, and that automatically does garbage collection. That's in the new .NET compilers. But in C++, we sort of have to dynamically deallocate our memory as well. And how do we tell the deconstructor from other things? We put a tilde in front of the class name. So whenever you see a tilde and then cball, then that's the deconstructor. So on slide 23, we're almost done it seems, but let's take a look at member functions. So oftentimes in our header file, we're going to define the class, which is what we did earlier in this slide series. We defined what the class is going to look like and what variables are contained in it and what functions are contained in it. But as far as implementing those functions, if they're short functions, sure, you can put them inside the class definition. But if they're longer, it might look a little better if you actually made a separate CPP file for all the function declarations. And we need to tell it, well, if I write a getX function, then this function is inside the class cball. So on slide number 23, when I write that function declaration, it looks kind of the same as normal functions, except I'm going to say that this getX function is a member of cball, and that's what the two colons there represent. I'm just saying that I'm declaring a function that was defined inside the cball class. And that's one way for the compiler to tell that this getX function isn't just a free-floating function, it's actually part of another class. So let's take a quick look on 24 of how we might use a class. And this is just a quick example. So we have our main function at the top. In the first example, we're going to statically allocate memory for the MyBall class. And by the way, when we statically allocate memory, then we are, for a class, then we only set aside memory for all the functions once, but we set aside memory for the variables every single time we instantiate a new class. So that's kind of important to know. So the size of your class is still going to be just the size of all the variables added together. But on slide number 24, we're going to statically allocate our class, MyBall, or the class object, you'd say. And then we're going to call some of its functions, and then it's going to move, and then that deconstructor is going to be called because we're exiting the main function, although this should have a return 0 since it's int main. So when that MyBall goes out of scope by going past the closing brace there, then it's going to be deallocated and thrown back to the operating system. and the deconstructor is going to be called. And in this case, the deconstructor probably doesn't do anything, but it would normally deallocate memory or free it. The second case is the case of dynamically allocating memory for a class. And just as before, we're using the new command to grab a pointer to this newly allocated memory. And the thing to note here is that we're using the arrows instead of the dots to access all of our class functions. And then finally, we have to delete our memory. Well, that can't go in the deconstructor, but when we delete that memory, the deconstructor will be called. So, on slide number 25, I'm going to post some homework very soon, and this homework will involve loading in bitmaps from files, pretty much everything that we've discussed so far in this lecture and last lecture. And we're going to hopefully display these bitmaps on the screen. So we'll be able to load in a background and display the background. So that'll be pretty neat. And that'll be due a week from today. And then our final project might be a ray tracing 3D engine or something. And that will use our sprite library that we just wrote. For example, if you want a menu screen, or if you want to put bad guys in the world, we can just paste sprites on the screen at the right locations. And lectures will end. We only have two lectures left, unfortunately, because I have to get ready for school. But lectures are going to end a week from today, so we have two more left. And the sprite library we're going to write for this homework. So we'll hopefully have that done a week from today. I'm also going to post the solution to last week's homework pretty soon as well. So if you haven't been able to write the line or the circle, then you'll have the code for that as well. So, and as always, if you finish with the homework, experiment and see what you can play with or figure out. So with that, I'm signing off, and I guess I'll see you all next week. Thanks for coming.